You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Massachusetts author Andrew Goldstein, whose new book is The Bookie's Son, published by 617 Books. Andrew Goldstein says that he's in the third act of his adult life. Act one, husband, writer, tree planter, assistant librarian, organic orange and olive farmer, school bus driver, Zamboni driver, editor, tennis pro, stockbroker, power transformer, tube winder. Act two, father, no longer writer, custom builder, youth soccer coach. And now act three, grandfather, table tennis player, writer again, living in Concord, Massachusetts, and enjoying waking up each morning to the birds chirping and the day that awaits him. The Bookie's Son is his first novel. When we spoke, I asked him to begin by reading from the book, and he started with an excerpt from the very beginning of The Bookie's Son.
I'm an extraordinary person trapped in an ordinary life, my mother used to tell me. Though my father was different from her in so many ways, he seemed to believe this about himself as well. And yes, at weddings and bar mitzvahs, they did shine. Dressed for ovations, they sauntered into the affairs like the royalty they considered themselves. What could the other guests say but stunning? What a handsome couple. Sure, the other families had their stars, a good merengue dancer, a mom who could belt out when the saints go marching in, like Ethel Merman. But could any woman at these celebrations sing half as nice as my mother, who had been a professional singer in the Catskills? At my cousin Joel's bar mitzvah, when she sang, "After you've gone, there's no denying, you'll feel blue, you'll feel sad, you'll miss the dearest pal you ever had," she brought the guests to tears and stole the bar mitzvah right out from under Joel, who was busy stuffing envelopes of cash into his pockets. What about my father? Was he going to let his wife steal the show with one of her torch songs? No way. He grabbed her away from the microphone and wowed the crowd, dancing a cha-cha with her beside the half-eaten chopped liver swan. When the music stopped, they smiled and waved at the other guests as they strolled to our table, the applause growing louder. That night, as my parents climbed into bed, I overheard them reminiscing. My father said, "That really was quite a cha-cha." After a long pause, my mother said, "We made the affair." She was joking, but I think she believed it all the same, which is why my father's latest screw-up was so disheartening. "Why did you marry Daddy?" I asked her many times. "Was it really the dancing?" I knew so little about my father, and almost everything I did know about him and his family came from my mother. Years before I was born, my father's sister Hannah climbed to the roof of the Lewis Morris Building, once the tallest building in the Bronx, over 13 stories high, and jumped. My mother told me that Hannah was the only sane sister. My father had 8 other sisters, each loonier than the next. Aunt Ruthie was a kleptomaniac, which made visiting her apartment on the Grand Concourse pleasant, because her closets were full of wonderful merchandise, hundreds and hundreds of knives, lighters, ashtrays, pens, brushes, and her collection of corkscrews from all over the world. For my parents' 15th wedding anniversary, Aunt Ruthie gave them a beautiful Chinese porcelain vase that my father had brought back from the war, and she had stolen from our apartment a few years earlier. Aunt Flo liked to be operated on. This need was so compulsive that she developed real diseases, kidney stones and gallstones and malignant tumors. When she finally died in her late 70s, she had had 52 surgeries. Aunt Ethel wasn't clinically insane, but her high opinion of herself and her transparent belief that she was right and you were wrong made her, at the very least, insufferable. She and my mother didn't speak for 7 years after she burst into the maternity ward an hour after I was born, slapped her hands together and shouted, "Pearl, Pearl, that is the ugliest baby I ever saw. He looks like a monkey, some kind of monster. What happened?" My mother told me that I didn't look that different than other babies, but with the blood disease and hereditary anemia, my skin was a little yellow, my eyes jaundiced, and I weighed only 5 pounds. So maybe my picture wasn't going to be on Gerber baby food jars. My mother had gone through a difficult labor, and it was August, and hot, and probably not the best time for Aunt Ethel to be her normal, insensitive self and shout her verdict. Monkey. Monster. Get the F out of here, you sick, crazy, pathetic F, my mother screamed from her bed. Pearl, why are you talking like this to me? I come all the way from Brooklyn, 2 hours on subways, and this is how I'm treated by my brother's wife? Get the F out of here, you sick, crazy, pathetic F, my mother screamed over and over. Nurses came running first, then the doctor with a tranquilizer. Before he injected the sedative, Aunt Ethel demanded an apology. When my mother told me the story, she performed it standing up, perfectly imitating Aunt Ethel, her stooped shoulders, her fleshy lips hovering over the bed, grabbing the doctor's wrist, not allowing him to inject his patient. I'm waiting, Pearl. I apologize for calling you a sick, crazy, pathetic F. Now get the F out of here, you constipated, effing lunatic.
Thank you very much. I love the aunts. I love so much about the family dynamic in this book. It's really fun. Let's just start by talking a little bit about what you inspired to write Ricky's story in this particular novel.
Well, the interesting thing is it's a novel, so it's fiction, obviously, but it's based on my childhood, so a lot of it's true, and I actually started writing the book 40 years ago.
Mm.
It just was there, and I had a nonfiction book published, and so I started writing this novel, and I just never could quite pull it off, and years went by, and eventually my daughter was born, and we needed money, and I began to, I was always working, but they were odd jobs, usually so I could just be writing, but now I had to get a real full-time job. And anyway, as the family grew, and I just put writing aside, just felt like, okay, maybe that was something in my childhood. And then about 12 years ago, when my children were grown, I just started writing again. I was working on another novel, and then I would go back to this old one, and I just loved it. I loved writing it. I was enjoying myself writing it. I would be laughing on my computer. So I just got back involved. And of the two novels, this is the one I would go to workshops, and it seemed like it resonated more.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seemed like, well, maybe this is the one I should finish first. And so it's just, to me it was a story that I think a lot of people could relate to. Not so much that they grew up with a bookie as a father, but it was a family that didn't have much money and they were trying to figure out how to make a life. And just the family dynamics that go on in it.
Yeah. So now I'm wondering, were you working all the time you were doing all the writing over these years? Or what's your background, Andrew?
Well, my background is I did a lot of odd jobs. Basically, in the early years, my wife really supported us, and I would work, I would work part-time jobs so I could write, and that lasted for many, many years. And I never really was quite happy with my job, so I was always quitting jobs and moving on. So I was a farmer, an organic orange and olive farmer for a while in California. I was a tree planter, an assistant librarian. To make some money, I read a book on tennis, and I became a tennis pro. So I eventually became the head pro at a club. And I drove a Zamboni, and I became a stockbroker, a tube-winder, General Electric, anything just so I could keep writing.
So wait, you became a tennis pro just by reading about it in a book?
Yeah, it was a good book. It was by Bill Tilden, and it was called Match Play and the Spin of the Ball. And I was, I was never a great player, like to play, in tournaments, but I was a good teacher.
Okay.
And so I put up signs, and I started drawing a following, and then luckily, at the right time, tennis was booming, and they built this 14-court, 6-indoor and 8-outdoor court in the Berkshires where I was living. And I started out an assistant pro, and then a pro, and then I became the head pro there.
Wow.
So that was great. Yeah, it was nice. It was a good time.
Hmm.
But again, these jobs, I always enjoyed my jobs for a while, but they weren't really my passion.
Right.
I really wanted to write. But, when you write over years and years and years and you don't make any money, so eventually I moved away from it.
Yeah. Well, part of the reading that you just did has to do with Ricky's mother, Pearl. She's such an interesting character. She works with celebrities in her job, and she's someone who once felt that she had a lot of potential herself to, you know, maybe become, I don't know, somebody more. Her relationship with Ricky is incredibly intense. And actually, if I could, I'd like to read a couple sentences from a scene. In this scene, Pearl is angry at her husband, and she's shouting at him about his, quote, stupid business, end quote, where he's working for some gangsters. And Ricky is witness to the argument, and here's a line. This is from Ricky's point of view. "Why are you screaming?" I cried. "More than my father's hands or insults, my mother's screaming shredded me. I didn't want her unhappy, didn't want to be the cause of her unhappiness. When screams exploded out of her like a geyser, I felt like the world was coming apart." And I just felt like that was such a great sentiment for a 13-year-old boy to be feeling about his mother. I think that's probably something that boys do feel about their mothers when they're upset. But anyway, can you talk a little bit about developing Pearl's character?
Well, let me first say that was easy to write because I remember my own feeling. I mean, that's pretty much autobiographical.
Okay.
My parents used to have these screaming fights every day, and my mother and I, in real life, as well as Ricky and Pearl in the book, were very close, and you know, and it hurt, you know, to see her suffering. In terms of developing her character, I mean, Pearl is a really interesting character because she's somebody who was and still is, though she may be fading a little bit, but a really beautiful, physically beautiful person. And she was a talented singer. She was artistic. Though she only graduated 10th grade, she was very bright, and she ended up working in the celebrity world because she always wanted to be. She always wanted to be either a singer or a movie star, but her dreams didn't happen. And so she was somebody who is now part of that world, but, you know, in a low position as just a secretary. But because she was so capable, her boss, who was a top theatrical lawyer in New York, gave her a lot of power. And so she read scripts and movie scripts and played and decided, you know, what was going to be produced on Broadway, and she had access, you know, to theater tickets. And it was an interesting world, actually, where someone like her and a secretary for David Merrick, who was the main producer at the time, they really controlled a lot of things of those times. But anyway, so Pearl, this person whose dreams are not being fulfilled, she's married to a man who, you know, in the book, she has always said she married him because he was a good dancer, and part of that was true. And you know, his life, he looked, when he was younger, he also was somebody who was a star. He was a great athlete, he was a great dancer, he was attractive, and he was making money when he was younger because he was hustling pool. But his life also, things are not working out. They have no money, he loses his money gambling. And so Pearl is a very unhappy woman. But she has this great job that gives her fulfillment. She's very loving, and she's trying to make a life.
Yeah.
Though, you know, her basic core, you know, she's married to a man that, you know, it's not working out, but she's part of a tradition in those days. I mean, people didn't get divorced.
Yeah.
I remember even in my real life, I lived in a Bronx neighborhood, and I would say, let's say, just like today, statistically, half the marriages weren't working out. But I know of no one when I was growing up, simply no one in the neighborhood, in my family, who got divorced. It just wasn't that common in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's basically trapped with this in this marriage that she doesn't like, but she's going to stay in it for the children. But yet she still believes somehow that, yet, you know, they're a great family, because
yeah,
she always tries to see things in a very positive light, and she tries to see the humor and stuff.
Right.
When she's not doing that, she's crying, and Ricky's, and she's, you know, and she, because she doesn't have this man in her life, in essence, she creates, her son becomes the man in her life.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure a lot of modern therapists wouldn't approve of, but she needed that.
Well, I think that probably happens not infrequently.
Yeah.
I just thought that the family dynamics were fabulous, and one of the things that really makes the dynamics more interesting is that Pearl's mother has come to live with them. And the grandmother's character is also fabulous. I really enjoyed her. She's sort of funny, and then sometimes she's more touching. And the whole family is just, there's a lot of love and a lot of fighting. And the grandmother just sort of tips the scales so that it's not balanced into these, you know, this little unit. You know, the grandmother sort of tips the scale. So I don't know, just was that what your family was like? Where
I say, it's an interesting thing about when you write a book and it's really based on some true stuff. So, I mean, there's fiction in the book, and, you know, I've been taught you don't tell people what's true and what's not true because you sort of destroy the dream of a novel. But in terms of the main characters, I would say the grandmother and the parent and Ricky, it's pretty much is who they were.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have to be imaginative in developing the characters because I had them. I had them in my real life, and I imposed them on the page.
But now, for some people, I think it's harder to write from your own life. It's almost harder to represent because you know what it was like, and it can be hard to convey that to a reader, not having lived through it. You know, the reader hasn't lived through it, so you have to make them live that life. I thought you did it very well. I felt this dynamic of this family. But did you? Was it hard for you?
Here's the easy answer to that. It's taken me 40 years.
Okay.
to write this book. So I would say, yeah. And I think that's why I struggled in the early years. I thought, hey, I got published young. I'm a good writer. And I just couldn't pull it off because I really didn't understand how you craft something like this into fiction.
Right.
And it was only when I started writing it 12 years ago, there's a group in Iowa called the Iowa Book Doctors, and I sent them some stuff, and I learned some things from them and then some other people. And then there's this great organization in Boston called Grub Street, which is just a wonderful literary community that every town or every, you know, major area should have. It's just a very, very cooperative place among writers and where they have a lot of workshops and stuff. So it was going to those classes with other really good writers and great teachers and learning something more about fiction that I was able to begin to see how you craft and how you take people from your real life and begin to make them into fictional characters.
Okay.
So, yeah, I would say it was quite difficult. You know,
yeah.
It wasn't difficult in the sense of it was never – I always enjoyed it, but it was difficult in that I just didn't know how to do it, and I had to learn the craft of doing it. So it took years and years of writing and drafts and going back and – more editing. I mean, I'm a writer that needs a lot of editors and a lot of editing, and I was able to get that there.
Yeah, that's great. I will, at this point, just pause and plug another writer really quickly. Another guest that's been on the show is Robin Hemley, and he has a great book called, I'm going to get the name of the book wrong, but it's something about creating fiction out of life. You know, anyway, it's a good book, so that's another little, I'll just mention that.
It comes up in discussion and workshops at Grub Street. I know there are different theories. Some people don't really think it's a good idea. You really should move away from people. You know, other people think it's great, and you just have to learn how to do it. And, you know, I don't have a particular philosophy either way. I just know this is the story I wanted to write.
Sure. Now, The Bookie's Son has a lot of aspects to the plot that are outside of this family dynamic. There's gangsters, there's the betting culture, there's a lot of violence, and there's sex, and sexual violence even a little bit. So I'm wondering if you can talk about that aspect of writing the book.
Well, let me see if I can talk about it. Can you ask me a more specific question about
Sure. Well, you know what? I guess my original question was, how much research did you have to do to write the book? I mean, did you already know a lot about betting and about crime in the Bronx in the 60s, things
right.
like that?
Yeah, as I say, this story was based on my childhood, so I did not have to do much research. When I was 10 years old in real life, I began taking bets. So my father, when he would be at work, he was a cutter.
Oh, wow. So even that aspect of it is from your life. Wow.
Yeah, and my grandmother, too. And my grandmother was almost blind, and she and I would be home fighting for the telephone because my father did not want her answering the phone. So he had me. And what I didn't remember, but my sisters pointed out to me, is that she was taking bets before me, and I just don't remember that. You know. But anyway, when I was 10, I started taking the bets, and then once in a while, my grandmother would answer the phone, and it was always a disaster because my grandmother would write with a pencil. English wasn't her first language anyway, and she would write on a napkin, and the napkin would have Wesson oil and some other stain on it. And she would read her writing. My father would come home, and he would see this bet that he couldn't understand who made it or how much it was for, and he'd start screaming at me, you know, because why did I let this person take the bet? And, you know, my grandmother was very willful.
Yeah.
So anyway, that whole world of betting and taking bets and gambling, I knew it very well. I was trained in it at an early age.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Okay. So now that I know that so much of this is from your own life, I'm curious, who's on the cover of the book, the couple?
Those are my real parents.
Those are your real parents. And then is that you, the inset photo? Is that you?
And that's me in the inset photo, yeah.
That's great. Who did the little in the pictures at the top of each chapter? There's a really nice set of drawings.
Well, here's the great thing that happened here, and it was never planned this way.
Right.
Both of my children are artistic. And my daughter, I was originally going to actually have some, I have a real picture on the cover, but I was going to have real pictures starting each chapter. And then, I don't know, one way, something, talking to people, whatever, it just seemed like I liked the idea of mixing fiction with facts, so it felt like that was a legitimate thing to do, but I was talked out of it. But then the compromise was to actually do these line drawings. So a lot of them are based on real pictures, some of them aren't. But anyway, my daughter did them. They're just very simple. And then my son designed the cover and designed the layout for the book. So what ended up happening here is that both my children ended up really helping me produce this book. And that was never part of the plan, but I feel so good about it right now. Because, you know, especially since it's a book based on my childhood and their grandparents and, you know, who they knew. And so anyway, I really, on just a personal level, there's nothing to do for readers. But on a personal level, I really enjoy that very much that they participated in it. And, at one point I hired a very good book designer, a professional book designer. And she had created a cover, and my son had created this cover. And I put it out on the internet to people to vote. And it was very interesting. Some people like the professional person better, but most people like my son's better. And I also asked people to tell me if they really thought one was a lot better, to let me know. And there was nobody that said that about the professional, but in terms of my son's, people who liked it were passionate about it. Yeah, it was far superior.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, I ended up going with my son, which I'm glad I did.
Yeah, that's great. It makes it more fun for you, too.
Yeah.
So, I want to read another little excerpt from the book. I've actually removed a few lines that had to do with the plot, because I'm only wanting to talk about the ambience of this moment and the details, if that's okay with you. Is that all right?
That's fine.
All right. When my mother got home from her canasta game, I went into the living room where she was sitting in her half-slip, pulled above her breasts, beside Grandma on the couch. They were watching Jack Parr, the volume turned up. The windows were open, but there was no breeze on this hot, humid night. I went to the window for some air. Fat Bertha across the street was wiping her forehead, and Joe was locking up the candy store. Smoke from his cigar rose toward the spotlight as three men stood smoking outside of Joe's, the red tips of their cigarettes glowing and dimming. I really loved that. Just the feel of the city, you know, the feel of the Bronx in 1960, the apartment buildings, the way the neighbors watch each other. It's very cinematic. And I wondered if you can talk a little bit about recalling the Bronx at that time and then bringing it up to date to write about it now.
Well, first of all, let me just say, I love the way you read it. The first time I've had it read, and I like the way you do it. Sometimes you read your own writing and say, ooh, that's not very good. But when you just read it, it sounded really good to me.
Good.
Maybe I'll have you read the book for an audio book. But anyway, the interesting thing, because that time, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, in my real life, you know, it's not a normal way to grow up. You know, your parents are doing some illegal things and you're taking bets at a young age. And my parents are, there's screaming fights going on every day. So I think what happens when you have that type of intensity, it really imprints itself strongly on your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so even now that it's 50 years later, I remember those images and I remember that time, you know, perfectly. You know, if I meet somebody, I can't remember their name or things, you know, a few seconds later. I don't have a good memory for a lot of things. But for the events of my childhood and stuff, I have very good recall.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is good. It's good for a writer to have that.
Yeah.
You know, and so anyway, when you look at my memory, which is faulty in so many ways in that area, it's pretty strong, and it still is. You know, I used to have a great memory for faces, and even that's, I don't quite have as what I once did. But the memory of those events, they're like, they're just, you know, I don't know exactly how the brain works, but I just think it just chemically, it just imprints itself so clearly there and so strongly that it's all there.
Yeah.
And then in terms of the Bronx, you know, I mean, one has to be careful that they don't romanticize something, because the Bronx was not a place, like for my parents and for the adults in the neighborhood, it wasn't a place people liked living. It wasn't a place they wanted to stay. They wanted to get out of the Bronx. The Bronx was a dead end. You know, the idea that my parents were still living in the Bronx when I was 13, believe me, this did not make them feel good, because they, you know, they would have thought they would have gotten out of the Bronx a long time ago. But
yeah.
For a child, and not for every child, but so I have to speak just to myself, but I think it's true for a lot. For a child growing up there, it was, and it's hard for a lot of people to understand it was really a wonderful place to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
It was dangerous if you got out of your neighborhood, and there were gangsters, and there were gangs, and there were bullies, and there was, you know, danger left and right as soon as you left your neighborhood. But within that block and within that neighborhood, it was just this paradise, because as you said earlier, there were people like the woman sitting in the window watching over the street, sort of protecting the neighborhood. Plus adults and children and old people, they all mingled on the street. It wasn't like everything is separate the way it is, the way I raised my children in the suburbs, where you have to drive your kids to every sporting event, and, you know, children stay with children, and people, old people are sort of in different areas of the country. But in the Bronx, everybody mingled. There was a candy store on the corner where everybody went, and everybody knew each other. And there were kids on every floor to play with, and you were out on the street at a very early age on your own. You were taking the subways and trains by yourself. You know, in real life, I did have a blood disease, and I used to travel by subways and buses when I was 8 years old all over the Bronx, go into hospitals by myself, deal with doctors and nurses. And that was, you know, wasn't that uncommon.
Wow.
You know, when I raised my own children, you know, I don't remember what age I allowed them to walk down to Concord, which is a very safe town, by themselves. It must have been like about 12, and I followed them, you know. You know, it's so crazy. But anyway,
yeah.
So anyway, I do have very fond memories of growing up in the Bronx.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that there wasn't some bad experiences, but in terms of a neighborhood and a way for a child to grow up, there were a lot of really good things about it.
Okay, great. I wanted to talk about your experience of publishing The Bookie's Son and 617 Books, what that is.
Okay, so 617 is really an interesting thing. And what's happening now, actually I just came back from a conference this weekend, but even besides that, what's happening in the publishing world now, as I'm sure you're aware and many of your listeners are who are writers, it's like it's just totally changing.
Yeah.
And it's like every day it's changing, and it's a wholly different world. And what 617 Books is a micropress. And there are other micropresses that I know of in the Boston area, and there's others in the country, but there's not a lot of them. And what a micropress is basically just a very, very small press. And this particular one was started by a writer, Michelle Toth, and she published her own book. And now she's publishing my book and a couple of other authors, and probably in the next year we'll publish a couple more authors. And it's really more of it's really a cross between self-publishing and traditional publishing. Where the publisher, what you have with a micropress is at least this one, I think most of it, is vetting. One of the problems with self-publishing is people can't really read their own writing correctly. I don't think any writer can. So
mm-hmm.
It's very easy for somebody to be fooled and think, oh, this is really good. So that's why I'm a real believer. You go to workshops, you get some independent editors to edit your book before you put it into print. Now, I'm not talking about friends. I'm talking about, you know, professional people, or at least go to a workshop with some very highly skilled, close readers that will really tell you the truth about your book.
Yeah.
And same thing with even after you do that, it's good to have some form of a publisher where there is that vetting, where there's some people saying, yes, this is ready for publication or it's not. So with the micropress, 617 Books, you get that. So you've been approved, I guess, in a certain sense. But after that, and the other thing you get with the micropress, you now have a few other writers who basically are trying to help you as you're trying to help them. So you're not alone in this world, because it's a really, you can be alone in the publishing world, but it's hard. And even with even if you're traditionally published, right now it's really hard. Let me give you a statistic that is just, to me, mind-blowing. I just found it out. In 1990, there were 25,000 books published in the United States. In 2011, there were 2,800,000.
Wow.
So you're talking a spike from 25,000 to 2,800,000. Many of those are self-published, some of them are digital, but it doesn't matter. You're now, you, the supply has increased so much, the demand has not increased that much. So how do you get that book into readers' hands when there's so many books out there?
Mm-hmm.
It's a really difficult problem. Anyway, so the micropress gives you at least the support of some other writers who are trying to help you as well. So I really like the micropress. The other really good thing about being published that way, and this would be true of self-publishing as well, is that you have time. Let me go backwards for a second. The main couple advantages of being published by a traditional publisher, one obviously is that you could possibly get an advance, but that's getting rarer and rarer these days.
Mm-hmm.
But whether you get the advance or not, the really big advantages of a traditional publisher is their distribution system. It's much better for getting into bookstores through a traditional publisher. It's also better for getting certain type of book reviews and stuff like that. But the problem with a traditional publisher, which is interesting, this is where a micropress or even self-publishing begins to have certain advantages, is that if you publish with a traditional press and you're not like really well-known or they don't decide to put hundreds of thousands of dollars behind your book, that book doesn't sell within the first couple of months. It's off the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
When you publish with a micropress or self-publishing or some other new version of these type of ways to publish, you can take your time. You can build a readership slowly. You can do a radio show like this. You do a blog and build. It's still very hard, but at least after 2 or 3 months, you're not done yet. You can spend a couple of years, slowly building up a readership and hopefully eventually have enough mass of readers that tell other people about it.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so for me, I'm publishing with 617 has been just a joy. Michelle Toth, who's the publisher, has been great, to work with. The writers have been great. And it's a relatively new concept.
So now that your book has been published by 617, do you then take on a role within the editorial staff?
I have, because I'm one of the initial ones. So I'm actually, I will be one of the people vetting other writers. And again, one of the weaknesses of a press like this is that because it's small and because we all have jobs and because we all have our own books and stuff to do, we really can't take on that many new authors. So right now we're thinking of a few new, I forget what we decided, maybe 4 to 6 books a year or something like that.
Yep.
And so that's right. Right now I would be now in that position of being one of the writers who looks at what comes in. And then we'd have to, we have to set our standards, and our standards are, at least 2 of the writers would have to approve it in order for to be. So I'm sure, and again, I'm sure there'd be a lot of, and right now we're doing it just on a referral basis because we just don't have the time to take in new work of people we don't know.
Sure,
so
sure.
Just be another writer that we know, but even then, if they sent a book, it doesn't mean it would be accepted because we really want to do it. If we put out a book, we want to feel really good about it.
Yeah. Okay. Now you said earlier that you are pretty much working on the marketing of the Bookie's Son right now, not doing a lot of writing, but are you working on anything new, or are you kind of thinking about it?
Well, yeah, I'm thinking about it a lot. I have another novel that I've been working on over the last 10 years, and I actually probably spent more time on that novel than the Bookie's Son, at least for a while there. And I should be working on it. I should be listening to my plan of getting up each morning and doing the writing. But as I say, it's a very interesting thing. The conference I just went to is called The Muse and the Marketplace. And it's just a perfect definition of what really exists. So you spend all these years with the muse writing it, and now there's the marketplace of selling it. And some writers don't like to get involved in the marketplace, and I totally respect that. But for me, I feel like, okay, I spent all these years, I do want readers, and I'm going to invest some time in the marketplace. And it turns out once you make that decision, there's a lot of time. It takes up a lot of time.
Sure.
Just on a computer all the time. I mean, and I'm just beginning, really. I don't, you know, at the conference I just went to, there's a lot of stuff on social media, and I'm not really good at it, and I'm just beginning to understand it. But it feels like if you're really going to do this, you have to really get involved in that as well. So I'm making excuses, but right now I'm not writing. But I hope to be, or I'm going to force myself to be within another couple of months.
Will your next book draw on your life, or is it something else?
The next book will be much more fiction. It's a story about a basketball coach.
What do you like to read? And is there anything you've particularly enjoyed lately, if you have time to read while you're marketing? I don't know.
I do. It's really important for a writer to keep reading. And sometimes when you're writing, you feel like, oh, well, I shouldn't be reading this or that, but you really have to, and I do. So, yeah, I mean, I usually read novels only because I'm writing novels right now. I want to see what other people are doing. I want to learn from them. And recently I read a couple of nonfiction. I'll mention them as well. But I would say the two books that I've read recently that I really have liked the best, one was The Art of Fielding.
Oh, yeah.
I've recommended it to people. Some people like it, some don't, but I really liked it a lot. I think he's a really good writer, Chad Harbach. And the other that I really, really was incredibly impressed with is actually a bunch of short stories, which I don't usually read that much, but these were so good. It's What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank by Nathan Englander. I just found him to be just a terrific writer. You know, last year I remember A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. I just loved that's a book that some do, some don't, but I really loved it a lot. The other book that I read recently, which is nonfiction, was Turing's Cathedral by George Dyson.
Okay.
And it's about the history of sort of the modern world of digital computing, which doesn't sound that interesting. And I'm not at all scientific or technological, so there's a lot in this book that I didn't understand. But I just found it so fascinating because it was the same. So when this whole thing was developed, it was some of the same people that had worked on the development of the atomic bomb.
And oh, wow.
It's just something you didn't know. It was a very, very interesting book. And so those would be, I think, the main books that I've read recently. I'm reading Steve Jobs now, the Walter Isaacson book, which is very easy to read, and I'm really enjoying that a lot.
Yeah, okay, great, thank you. So, okay, I just have one last question for you, Andrew. This is a question for writers who are listening, and perhaps for writers who share your experience of having worked on a project over a period of years, you know, refining it, seeking help and advice, and then trying to decide where to go with it. You know, what advice do you have? I don't mean necessarily advice for getting published, but advice for sticking through that process emotionally and intellectually and doing the best thing you can for your book.
I think, you know, some people who are really good writers don't even like writing. Mm-hmm. But yet they do it. And then there's people like me that love writing. I just, you know, I really, really enjoy it. And I think no matter who you are, and certainly for me this is true, some days you're just going to write some really terrible stuff. And it's just going to be junk. It's sloppy writing. And I think this is true from some really of the great writers as well. But, you know, I can only speak from my own personal stuff. So someday you're going to write that junkie stuff and you're going to really feel, oh, my God, what am I doing here? And I think you just have to accept the fact that that's part of the process and that doesn't mean anything. There's nothing negative about that. It's part of the process, and there are going to be days that are going to be much better. And I think the key thing for a writer in the modern world, I don't know if it was true years ago or not, is, in fact, that in the writing, eventually in trying to get a publisher, eventually if you get it published, in the marketing, every one of these things that's called those, it's really like, really there's really three steps, not really two, because there's the writing, there's the finding a publisher, which can take years, and then there's the marketing afterwards.
Yeah.
So every one of those steps, you are going to have bad days. Days when the writing's not good, days when you get rejection letters, days when, you know, nobody's reading your book, you can't find the readers for your book, and you just have to recognize that this is true for everybody. I mean, mm-hmm. There's always those exceptions, fine, but, you know, we're talking, when I say everybody, I'm talking about the 99% of people who are writing, not the 1%, or maybe they're famous and they wrote a book and everything went easy for them or something like that. But for the most writers, this is the course, and regardless We're all different, but the pattern is the same. You're going to have these bad days and these good days, these bad days and these good days, and hopefully what you're getting out of it is the enjoyment and satisfaction of one producing the book in the end. I mean, in other words, when you're done with your book and you've done your best at it, well, you know, it's very hard to complete, let's say, a novel, but really any book. You just completed, it's a major accomplishment, and that person should be really proud of themselves. And then if they can find a publisher or get it published somehow, that's another accomplishment. And then if they can find readers, that's another accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all going to be on a different point in that graph, you know, and some people are going to have more success than others. But I think people have to find, solace in what they've accomplished themselves and not get discouraged in any way by the down days.
Okay. It makes perfect sense. That's a great answer. Thank you. Thank you so much. Andrew Goldstein, the book is The Bookie's Son, and it's published by 617 Books. Where can people buy this?
People can buy it everywhere now. In other words, they could buy it. I have both a print copy and a e-book copy, and they can get it on Amazon. They can get Barnes & Noble. They can do it on their Kindle, their Nook. They could order from their bookstore.
What's your website, Andrew?
My website is andrewgoldstein.org.
Okay. All right, great. Well, listen, thank you so much for being on Write the Book.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Sheila. I really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Andrew Goldstein. You can read more about his work at his website, andrewgoldstein.org. Today's Write the Book prompt is to write a setting from your childhood. It might be the bedroom you had before your family moved to another town when you were in high school, or it might be the street in front of your house, such as that scene that I read from Andrew's book, The Bookie's Son. It might be a scene from your kindergarten classroom or from the backseat of your parents' car. Try to capture the details that will help readers understand what it was like to be in that place, and in particular to be you, your childhood self in that place. Consider colors as you write and odors, the smells from the kitchen as your mother cooked, or the sound of a vacuum, the sounds of your parents talking from the other side of a closed door. What was it like to be there? Was it air conditioned? Did the heater go all the time so that the windows had to be left open even in the winter? What made you feel particularly safe or comfortable or frightened? Try to capture it and then see how you might use it, or simply see what you learned from writing it in a larger piece of writing. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please go to Write the Book Radio Show page on Facebook and like us. And if you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And as always, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, or if you have a writing prompt to suggest, or anything else that you'd like to say, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about getting involved or just about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. I want to mention that next week's show is an interview with Julia Alvarez, the Vermont author, and it's about her new book, A Wedding in Haiti. That interview was actually conducted at RETN television station, and it's going to be broadcast on Channel 16 as well as on The Radiator. I will be posting more information about that at the website writethebook.podbean.com, so you can find out how to watch it on TV if you'd like, or just listen in next week and you'll hear it on The Radiator, Monday at 2. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.